But before we started today, when we were having coffee, by the way, there's going to be more coffee after we finish. So if you haven't had one or you want a second one, Danny, thank you very much. He will be hanging around a bit. And please have some fruit and cake. But I don't feel so bad now because we were talking before. We're having coffee and I was just asking a couple of people about their birthday. And I have an app that we can figure out Hebrew birthdays very quickly. And so I'm now sharing the celebration with Mandy, who has a very special birthday tonight. She thought it was a few weeks ago, but the real birthday is tonight. Other birthdays somewhere, I don't know when it is, but when is it? A few weeks, right? So lots of mazel and bracha.
Thanks, Rabbi.
And only good things. So my birthday is actually not today. Today my birthday is the 6th of Tammuz, which is a Sunday. But we always mark it on Thursdays, so that's how we do it. But today is a very special day, and that's why every year I try to connect sort of my birthday experience with the 3rd of Tammuz, which is today. And it's the Yahrzeit, it's the passing of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who I had a very strong connection with. When I say a strong connection, he was a world leader, but I was one of his hundreds and thousands of followers. But I was... In his yeshiva, I studied for a number of years in 770, where he worked from, and he studied and spoke. So I thought that what I would do today, and he spoke a lot about the concept of birthday, as I said. So today it's 32 years since he passed away. And since I was dedicating this to my birthday, which is Sunday, so I thought what I'd do today is share something personal. Extrapolate a bit with other stories and concepts, but I want to share with you a private audience that I had with the Rebbe when I was 13 years old. I'll give you the context so you understand. So the Rebbe was a huge leader. He was a global leader, an unbelievable scholar, a teacher, a guide, a tzaddik, a holy person. There's hundreds of stories that I could tell you about that. Was connected he loved Jews, bottom line. Like he go to the nth degree to help people, to inspire people, to guide people, always loving them, always embracing them, always accepting them the way they are, but at the same time pushing them to grow. Growth was a big thing by them. In fact, someone just asked me before, what's the one thing that I wish on my birthday? And I had to think, that's an interesting question. Actually, it was a clever question. And I thought about it and I said, growth. Growth can be in different areas, but I think growth is like the... And he would speak about that concept on a birthday. One should reflect and also reflect on how one can grow more, right? In their own journey, in their own becoming a better person, more spiritual person, godly person, and so on. So the Rebbe was the 7th Chabad Rebbe. So the Chabad is a movement that's around for like 250 years. And the Rebbe was the 7th Rebbe. It started from Shnei Zalman of Ladi, who was the first Chabad Rebbe, the author of the Tanya. And the Rebbe was the 7th Rebbe. He was related to, but also the son-in-law of the previous Rebbe. So when the previous Rebbe came to America in 1940, the previous Rebbe had lived through real communist persecution, and then he was in Poland for a while, and then the war broke out, and eventually, miraculously, he was saved, and he came to America in 1940. And the Rebbe, who was also trapped in Europe with his wife, the previous Rebbe's daughter, he was trapped in France and different places during the war and kept on running and eventually also miraculously made it to New York in 1941 and worked very closely with his father-in-law. And then in 1950, the previous Rebbe passed away and the Rebbe took the mantle of leadership, which he passed away in 1994. He became sick with a stroke in 1992, and then 1994 he passed away. And when the Rebbe took over, he initially was very reluctant to become the Rebbe. He was a very humble person, very behind-the-scenes person. But he was a very special person. Even people knew that before he became the Rebbe, and they pushed him for a whole year, the Rebbe wouldn't officially accept the position of being the Rebbe of the Chabad movement. Chabad movement was a lot smaller in those days. It was America, it was the Holocaust, things had moved and shifted. And eventually, on the first Yahrzeit of the previous Rebbe in 1951, he sort of officially took it on. And once he took it on, he said, in fact, at the very first Farbrengen, his first public address, when he said a maimer, he said a Hasidic discourse, which was symbolic of him accepting the mantle of leadership. All the Hasidim were so happy afterwards, and they have a Rebbe, they have a new Rebbe. And then he stopped everyone and said, "Now listen," he says, "you have to understand how it works. I'm not going to do this alone. And I'm going to drive you hard," basically. He didn't say in those words, I'm paraphrasing. He said, "I'm going to work you hard, and I'm going to push you, and we're going to do this together, right?" And one of his focuses, of course, don't forget, 1950 wasn't that long after the Holocaust, and the Jewish world was in a state of real brokenness and needed rebuilding. And he took it upon himself to be involved in the rebuilding of Judaism, essentially, in America and other places all over the world, right? And he did that. He never, ever took a break, never took a holiday. Literally, he was in his office 7 days a week, including Shabbos, because Shabbos he would teach and talk and inspire. And he was a person that, even other tzaddikim and even his father-in-law took a break, or whatever it means, a break. They would go sometimes to other places to rest, away from the community. The Rebbe never, ever did that. And just kept on working and working every day to build up Judaism, to strengthen Yiddishkeit, to inspire people, to teach people, and to reach out. And one of the things, of course, as we know, he built up this campaign of sending people all over the world, right? Which is why I landed in Australia. Only because when I got married, it was very clear to me and to my wife that we need to go somewhere to teach, to spread Judaism, to connect with people. And the Australian connection happened because I was here as a student and they were looking for someone and the whole story. So that's how I landed up in Australia. So everything I do in Australia, I hope I've done something, is really credit to this concept, the concept of what he called shlichut. Now, one of the customs among Chabad Rebbes from the beginning was this concept called yechidut. Yechidut means that apart from publicly speaking and answering letters, and when you had a question, you'd write in a note and sometimes you would answer or give a blessing, whatever the case was. But also this concept that Hasidim would have the opportunity from time to time to have a private audience with the Rebbe. And that was considered one of the most special things in Chabad tradition. It wasn't only Hasidim, it was everyone. All kinds of people came. And that was considered the deepest connection when you go one-on-one sort of with the Rebbe and you would ask for a bracha, whatever the case was. It was considered very, very special. Now that went on, the Rebbe did that. That used to happen, the way it used to happen was, I'm just giving you a bit of context before when I sort of get into my story. But that would happen at night, like a couple of times a week. The Rebbe would start somewhere in the night, I think 8 o'clock or something, 9 o'clock, and it would go through the night. And sometimes your slot could be 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. That was the custom. In fact, you never knew when your slot would be there. The secretary would give you an approximate time, but they had no idea of how long each thing would take. Sometimes the Rebbe would keep someone longer. So you just waited. People would come. They would say Tehillim, men, women, whatever it was. And then your chance came. Now that stopped after a while because it stopped in the early 80s. It stopped in the early 80s because it was impossible. It became much too much. The movement grew to such an extent that private audiences became, and the Rebbe was a little bit older, and his health was, although he was still very strong, but so that kind of stopped. But instead, the Rebbe started the famous, in order still to have that private connection, the Rebbe started that famous Sunday Dollars. For those who don't know, the Sunday Dollars was a thing where every Sunday the Rebbe would come out and the people would queue up. And he would give each person a dollar for a blessing, but the point of the dollar was to give it to tzedakah, right? Or something in its place. I mean, no one gave the actual dollar away, at least to keep it, but they'd replace it with another dollar or more, whatever, and give it to charity, which was a concept that Rebbe had in general, that when two Jews meet, there has to be a benefit for a third person. That was his motto. So that was the idea. You meet someone, something has to come out of it for another person. So that was the concept of the dollar. Sometimes you would give an extra dollar, sometimes for extra bracha or for other people, whatever the case was. And this would go on every Sunday, and then it would come out sometime in the morning or midday and go for hours. Like it would go like sometimes 5 hours, 6 hours, thousands and thousands of people would file past. If you needed something, people didn't like to talk to the Rebbe themselves, but like it was, out of respect. But if you needed something urgent or you needed to ask something, you would say something very quick. And then the Rebbe would answer. You have to be quick because it was a fast-moving line. The secretaries would move you along unless the Rebbe stopped you and spoke to you, right? The only time I ever said something to... Actually, twice. The only time I ever said something to the Rebbe on the dollar line was before I came to Australia, I went through the sun, because I came in, we came in July, actually. Then next week, 4th of July. We came the 6th of July, sorry. We left, my wife always laughs because we left America on the 4th of July, which wasn't very patriotic of her. But she was a very proud American. Not anymore, but she was. But she was. My birthday was not long before that, so I went by the Rebbe. And I remember that time my birthday was Tuesday, and I was very nervous, but I quickly said to the Rebbe, I have a birthday on Tuesday, and the Rebbe gave me an extra dollar with a bracha, and it was very beautiful. And I think last time was actually before we came, and I said we're going to Australia, and he gave us the extra bracha. So that was, and then also he would have a couple times a year, he would have, like, if guests came for a special day, he would have like a communal audience just with the guests that came and speak to them, and everyone had a chance to file past and that kind of thing. So I lived in South Africa, I was born in South Africa, and grew up there. And my grandfather, who was Rabbi Eloy, one of the well-known rabbis in South Africa, he was a lovely grandfather, an amazing person. And he gave us a bar mitzvah present, my older brother, and then myself, and then my younger brother. And for my bar mitzvah, he took me to see the Rebbe. He took me on a whole overseas trip, actually, always. It's another story, because I was such a kid that I didn't even understand it, how great it was. That a very, very busy communal person should take off a month. Just took off a month just to travel with a grandchild. We went for 2 weeks to the Rebbe in America, and then a week to Europe and a week in Israel. It was the most amazing trip. It was like unbelievable. But so he took me to the Rebbe. It was just after my mitzvah. We went a couple of days after my birthday, this time of the year. And it was the time then that the Rebbe was still doing yichidus, still having private audiences. And I had the great fortune of actually having one with the Rebbe. And it was so special because what used to normally happen was if someone came with family, right, they'd go in together. So like if a grandfather and a grandson would come together, they would go in together. Or husband and wife, they're going together. What happened with me was that we decided it's not going to happen like that because my grandfather had stuff that he'd written to the Rebbe to ask questions about the rabbinate in South Africa and community stuff. A lot of it was private. And so, I don't know, for some reason it started, it's better that he goes in first and then I go in afterwards. I guess maybe he started that with the secretaries, I'm not sure. In fact, when he went in, the Rebbe knew that we were there. And the Rebbe said to him, welcome again. Where's your grandson? So my grandfather threw me under the bus. He says, he wants to come in alone. It wasn't exactly the way it worked, but it was just started like that. So the Rebbe said, no, he just became bar mitzvah as an adult. He wants to act like an adult. That was the anyway, so he went in and the Rebbe kept him for half an hour. The Rebbe asked him a lot of questions as well. I remember the secretary standing outside were getting very nervous because their job was to keep it flowing, keep it moving. Because you weren't supposed to take up the Rebbe's time, but my grandfather says it wasn't me. I just had a few questions. I could have been done in 10 minutes, but the Rebbe kept me. He was asking me questions about family, about South Africa, the whole thing. And then I went in and I was like about 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes in the Rebbe's room, just me and the Rebbe. I was very nervous before I went in, I remember, 13-year-old kid. And as soon as I came in, I was calm. It was very fascinating. I remember it very clearly. I remember the whole thing very, very clearly. So I want to just share some reflections about that 5 minutes as I advertised and talk about some things that the Rebbe would, that afterwards I realized was very much part of how the Rebbe looked at things. So the custom was, when you went into this private audience, you didn't speak, meaning you answered questions, but you didn't speak. What we used to do is we would write on a piece of paper, like called a tzettel, a pidyon. We'd write what we need, we'd write our name, our Hebrew name, and the mother's name, and then we'd write any question that we have. Now I was a young, very, thank God, very sheltered South African with no worries in the world, so I didn't have any major sorrows to talk about. But Baruch Hashem, at that stage, I was just young and... but we So I wrote just to my grandfather, helped me write the letter. It was just, I'm here, I'm asking a bracha, I've just had a bar mitzvah, I'm asking a bracha for the Rebbe, and I asked for what, you know, that I should grow up and be strong in Torah mitzvahs and learn and nachas my parents and all that kind of stuff. So I went into, so before I tell you about the actual conversation, I want to just tell you about something that I reflected on later. And later on, I understood the greatness of this opportunity. That someone who is truly a global leader, I'm talking about someone who, there was a time when the Rebbe used to get more mail than the President of the United States. And I remember this as a student. I remember 770, I remember the postman coming. Right? This is pre-fax even, pre-fax and pre-everything, right? I remember sacks and sacks, right? So that we had huge sorrows of so many people all over the world asking advice and seeking blessing and all that kind of stuff. He had a lot of global things that he was working on, the whole shlichut idea, sending out people. He was always concerned and very involved about what was happening all over the world, of his emissaries. He was very involved about in the Jews of Russia at the time of Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, which was, you know, the Jews behind the Iron Curtain. Very involved in Israel. There were many, many politicians of Israel who sought his advice, who came to see him, sometimes for hours. If you ever read Yehuda Avner's book, The Prime Ministers, you can see his experiences with the Rebbe. Very long conversations. The Rebbe was very involved in intricate details of what was happening in Israel. And he had a connection with many, many, many politicians there. Rabbis would come see him for communal stuff. This was someone who was, and he would publish every week. He would talk for hours. He would, there was a publication that came out from the Rebbe every single week, edited works of his talks, and very deep, and he would spend a lot of time in that. He would spend time learning, I'm assuming. And yet I thought about it, this Rebbe was okay to spend even 5 minutes, but with a 13-year-old pipsqueak who's got no worries in the world and fully focused. When the Rebbe would talk to someone, even by dollars, by the way, sometimes the Rebbe would talk, I've witnessed this so many times, watching in the videos and even seeing it also with people in front of me in the line. The Rebbe would sometimes spend 10 seconds or something, but that 10 seconds was fully there, fully present, right? I thought this was really amazing, and I thought it's amazing, but it's also very something I spoke about before, something that was very, very part of the Rebbe's leadership. Because in leadership, and this goes for all of us really, sometimes we think about bigger picture stuff, right? And the Rebbe was certainly involved in huge bigger picture stuff. And yet, individuals are very important to him, because community, in Judaism, community is unbelievably important, but community is made up of individuals, right? By the way, that goes for all of us. We all have a leadership position. We talked about this before. We all have a circle of influence, and we treat it, that circle of influence, we can treat it like a group, which we should. The group needs, and group what the group has to have, and what's important for that group. But we also have to remember that that group has individuals that are very different, right? And the Rebbe, for him, one single person was created in the image of God, and one single Jew had a Jewish neshama, and that was a world, a whole world. And there's so many stories about how that one person is so important. I want to just tell you a few stories so you can understand what I mean. Little things, small things. Have I ever told you the story of my wife with her dollar? No? Okay, I'll tell you the story. It's an amazing story. I mean, it's an amazing story on many levels. So we came here in 1988, and those days there was a very big invention. Now it's like a dinosaur, but the invention was the fax machine, for those who remember the fax machine. So it became a thing where now you don't have to mail a letter to the Rebbe anymore. If you're far, you can send a fax, and the secretaries would pick it up. They would take it into the Rebbe, and if the Rebbe had an answer, he would answer or whatever. So I had this thing when I came. I was here, I came with Dina and my oldest daughter, who's now Mushki Chaitin. And my wife was pregnant, and then a few months later we had my second son who lives now in New York. So I had a thing, and I came in 1988. 1992, the Rebbe had a stroke. So for those 4 years, I had this custom that every birthday, again, getting back to the concept of a birthday, my birthday, Dina's birthday, and the two children, I would write a short fax to the Rebbe. It's this and this one's birthday. This is what they're turning. I'm asking a bracha for the coming year. It should be a good year for them, physically, spiritually, and so on. I'd write in Hebrew. I always write in Hebrew. You don't have to. The Rebbe used to get letters in all languages, but that's what I used to do. And The Rebbe never answered because Hasidim had a tradition that you don't need an answer from the Rebbe. If you ask him for a bracha, if he receives it, he takes care of it. You don't have to worry about if he's acknowledging it, he's answering, you're not answering, but he never answered except for once. Interesting thing, for some reason, I once wrote in for my oldest daughter's birthday, she must have been, I don't know, 2 or something, and the Rebbe answered to observe I learned something very interesting, because the Rebbe has a whole bunch of customs you're supposed to do on a Jewish birthday. And the Rebbe answered that to ask that I should keep the customs of a birthday, which I assume meant me, not her, because she was 2 years old, which is interesting. It means parents should also like observe their children's birthday. And I should check my mezuzahs, out of the blue, which I did, and some of them weren't kosher. So that was interesting, for some reason, that they'd be written wrong. So obviously I replaced them. But otherwise, I never got an answer. Okay. In 1991, Dina's brother got married in Israel. And she went to the wedding with, I was the principal of a boys' high school at the time, and I just, it was the time that I just couldn't go, and we had just gone a few months before. And so she went with our 2 kids, young kids. She went via America and to see her family and to see the Rebbe, and then was off to Israel. The Sunday before she left Israel, she went by the Rebbe, and she really wanted to ask a bracha for the trip and for her pregnancy. She was pregnant there with Rabbi Levi, which she very quickly did. She said, I'm going to Israel, and also I'm asking a bracha for the pregnancy, which the Rebbe gave an extra dollar for each one and gave a big bracha for the birth should be okay and all that. And then my oldest son, in other words, his birthday was a couple of weeks to go. His birthday just before Pesach. This was like 3 weeks, I think, on the 6th of Nisan. So my wife pointed to my son Moshe in the carriage and said, it's his birthday. In Yiddish, she said, it's his birthday, the 6th of Sivan, of 6th of Nisan. And the Rebbe turned to Dina and said, he gave an extra dollar for the bracha, and he turned to her and said, and you don't have a birthday? Which is a very strange question to ask someone, right? I mean, like, by definition, I think everyone has a birthday. I mean, if you're born, you had a birthday, right? And she became very flustered. She didn't know what to answer, and she said, Shein given, it was already. And the Rebbe smiled, oh, it was already, that's good. That was it. I'm sitting in my office Monday morning. It's 14 or 16 hours ahead, whatever it is. And Dina calls me, she says, this is like a funny, very strange story. I went by the Rebbe for dollars. I got a bracha for Moshe's birthday. And then the Rebbe asked me this question, which I subsequently saw, because they videoed all these dollars, and I got the video and I saw it. And I don't know what it means, because we had a tradition, if the Rebbe asked you something about dollars, there's something in it, right? It's like, you wouldn't just randomly ask questions. There was always a purpose. And I said, I don't know. I don't know what that means. Why would you ask someone if they don't have a birthday? And I put down the phone, and it just was on my mind, and suddenly it clicked. Because Dina's birthday was a few weeks before she was there, and it was the first time since I got to Australia that I forgot to write a fax. I didn't notify the Rebbe about her birthday. And the Rebbe noticed. Thousands and thousands of letters, thousands and thousands of thousands, oh, there she is, thousands and thousands of it's unbelievable. But why was that important? Besides the greatness of it and remembering and understanding and then picking it up, the one person didn't write for the birthday. And he never answered me. He never acknowledged my fact, which was fine, because I mean, we have a tradition, it didn't matter, the blessing was there. But it was like asking, you don't have a birthday? Like, I didn't hear from you this year, like, what happened, you know? So, but it also goes back to the power of an individual. I want to tell you 2 more stories and then get on to the actual conversation. One is, I told you that when the private audiences stopped, the Rebbe used to have this thing where if a bunch of guests came for a special day, like a yontif or whatever, afterwards he would, in the big shul, he would come and he would speak to the guests as a general bracha, rather than having private audiences. And after that, they would file by the Rebbe, everyone, the men, the women, and they would each give the Rebbe a note, like asking a bracha what they want. The Rebbe would take it, didn't read it then, he would take it away, and would give each person a bracha. A dollar for tzedakah, that's what it was. So one time there was this communal yechidut, as we call it, and a family went in, and one father, he went in with a very young son, and a 2-year-old son or something. And he wanted to make sure the kid keeps quiet during the Rebbe's talk. So he gave him a pen and a piece of paper to draw, to scribble. And it worked, scribbling it. And the Rebbe spoke for a while, then the Rebbe came to the end of the talk, and everyone went into line to give their note and to receive a dollar. And this person, and he forgot about the paper that he'd given to the child, was scribbling, I think it fell on the floor, whatever. Again, he comes to the Rebbe with his son, and he hands the Rebbe an envelope with his note, and the Rebbe takes it, and then the Rebbe starts scanning the floor, and says, your son's note. And they went to pick it up, and the Rebbe took it. The scribble from a child, right? Because it doesn't matter who you are. I mean, this was the Rebbe's leadership. It doesn't matter you're a big rabbi, you're a big important person, or you're a tiny child. It's the same neshama. Each one has a different mission. Each one is at a different stage of their journey. But the Rebbe felt that even a two-year-old child that was scribbling during the yichidut, it's an important thing. So he wanted that paper also. And I'll tell you a story that I know to be true because, you know, it's always nice to verify stories because stories do get embellished sometimes. But I know the story because I heard it from the person that it happened to. And it happened a long time ago. And it's also about how the Rebbe worried and felt the neshama of every single Jew. Right? This story was told by a person called Rabbi Weinberg. Rabbi Weinberg was a rabbi. I remember him very well because he came from Poland, but he lived in America. He was quite an important chassid and a follower of the Rebbe. His job, his day job, was he was a fundraiser, actually, for the Chabad yeshivas in New York. And because of that, he used to travel a lot. And because he used to travel a lot, often the Rebbe would give him things to do while he was traveling. And he would use out his trips also to talk and inspire people. He was a good speaker. I remember he used to come to South Africa a lot. He was coming to South Africa even before the Rebbe became Rebbe. He was coming to South Africa from 1948, from the previous Rebbe's times. And so this story happened in the 1950s. Amazing story. Where he was going to South Africa. He used to go to South Africa and Brazil. So he was going to South Africa this time, and he went into the Rebbe. Those days, 1950s, was easier to have a private audience. Even people who lived in New York could do it. And he had a private audience to the Rebbe to ask him a bracha for the trip. In those days, traveling was quite hard. To go to South Africa, it wasn't a direct flight. You had to stop at a number of places, including a place called Dakar, which is like off Africa or something. You know me, my geography is not very good, but it's somewhere on the way. So he gave the Rebbe his itinerary. The Rebbe asked him, like, how are you traveling? Then the Rebbe looked at him and said, often the Rebbe would say things, again, like the same thing with the dollars. He would say things to people that only became clear later. The Rebbe said to him, you're not stopping for a day or two? She says, no, that's not the way the ticket is going. Is it? No. And then a few minutes later, the Rebbe repeated it. And he said, and you're not stopping for a day or two? Anyway, he goes home. He said, no, he repeated what he answered. That's not. So he went home and he told his wife the following, because in those days, you know, there was no WhatsApps and quick calls and I've arrived safely and all this kind of stuff. You know, like today, if a person's 3 seconds late on the WhatsApp, they arrived safely, you start to worry. Those days wasn't like that, but when he would get to South Africa, he would send a telegram. I've arrived safely. He goes on. Before he goes, he says to his wife, if you don't get a telegram from me, don't worry, because I have a feeling I'm going to get stuck somewhere. The Rebbe said it twice in the conversation. Day or two, like, I think it's, yeah, we're going to get stuck, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, he doesn't know what this means. He goes in the plane. He meets someone else in the plane, another Jew who's going to South Africa because he had a daughter that lives there. Guy lives in New York. And he's very happy. They knew each other. It's always nice to travel with someone you know. Okay, they land in Dakar. It's a stop for a few hours. They get inside the airport. While he's in the airport, he sees someone looking at him. And then eventually he sits down and he opens up a safer to learn something while he was waiting. And he obviously the guy could see that he's wearing a kippah. And he runs over to him and he says, are you Jewish? Turns out this guy was, his last name was Pinto. He came from a very prominent Sephardi family. And he came from Egypt and he was working there in Dakar for something. So Rabbi Weinberg asks him, do you know any other Jews? He says, no, I don't know any other Jews and it's very lonely here. And so he starts to speak to him for those couple of hours and talks to him about maybe the mitzvah of putting on tefillin, and he makes him promise that he's going to start putting on tefillin. And this guy says, you know, it's a very, very, it's beautiful that we met because my wife's going to be very happy. Her father's a big chacham, and I used to put on tefillin, but now I'll be very happy that I'm continuing. And that conversation comes to the end, and they get back on the plane. Plane takes off. 2 hours later, there's an announcement. He was sleeping already, he'd fallen asleep, and everyone awakes that we're landing. Where are we landing? Back in Dakar. Why? Engine trouble. Okay, they land. Before they disembark, the captain comes on this loudspeaker. He apologizes profusely. He has bad news because the one engine like sort of is kaput, the other one wasn't working that way either. And they have to wait for a part from England. They have to send a plane, and it's got to come from England, so it's going to take 2 days. Okay, he realized it was escaped 2 days. Then he said, when he tells the story, I just heard him tell a story recently. I listened to a recording of him telling a story. So this Lenger, the other guy that was traveling with, comes over to him, all worried. He says, panicked. He says, you know, 2 days can mean 4 days. It can mean a few days. And then we're going to get stuck here on Shabbat. And where are we going to find stuff for Shabbat in Dakar? I mean, he starts panicking. So he turns to this guy and he says, we're not getting stuck here more than 2 days. I'm telling you. I know. He says, how do you know? He says, before I left, the Rebbe asked me that question twice. You're not stopping over for 1 or 2 days? So I'm telling you, it's not going to take more than 2 days. It's going to be on time. You have nothing to worry about. Okay? So they check into an hotel. So he decides he's here. He's obviously a purpose, especially that the Rebbe had mentioned this. So there's a mission, right? The mission is he's got to find a Jew. He comes out. They spoke French then. I think he doesn't know a word of French, but he knew a little bit of Portuguese. So he found someone. He overheard someone talking Portuguese. So he goes up to him and says, "Excuse me, in Portuguese." He says, "Are there any Jews around here?" So the guy says, "Yeah." As a matter of fact, yeah. And he points to a store. Points to a store where it's a Jewish owned business. He goes there and there's one guy there. He says, "This is your store?" He says, "No, it's my uncle's. It's a family thing, but we're here also from Egypt." And he starts talking to him, and then Rabbi Weinberg says to him, "Are there any other families here?" He says, "Yes, there's 4 Jewish families here. It's 4 in the town, there's 4 Jewish families. Very lonely, very forsaken almost, but we're here and we make do." So he says, "Look, let's meet them." So he makes a whole thing that night. Meets all the families, but mostly over the next 2 days, he spent time with this one guy, a single guy that he'd met there, the nephew of the person that owned the business. And they talked about Yiddishkeit, and they talked about maybe having things to learn, maybe he can send them things in French. He talked about tefillin, he said they can send them some mezuzahs, some tefillin. And it was an amazing 4 days. Part of those 4 days was he spoke to this guy about, very strongly, about marrying Jewish. And the guy promised him, he says, "Yeah, you can't find anyone here in Dakar. I'm going to go to France and find a Jewish girl," right? Okay. When he comes to South Africa, and 2 days later, not delayed, 2 days, gets on the plane, and they go to South Africa. When he came to South Africa, he right away wrote a letter to the Rebbe to report on what happened. And then the Rebbe right away activated his office to start sending material to them. Before Pesach, the Rebbe's secretary calls him up and says, "The Rebbe wants to send matzah now to Dakar, so they should have matzah for Pesach." And there was a lot of contact. Later on, a number of months, then he eventually arranged some people to travel there for Rosh Hashanah, so they should have a minyan. And they were, and then some of them wrote a letter to the Rebbe, which the Rebbe then sent out to Rabbi Weinberg. You should see it, thanking the Rebbe, and because he spoke to them about the Rebbe, and he told them the whole story, how wise in Dakar, the Rebbe sort of predicted he's going to be there. And they wrote like they just couldn't believe it that someone in New York is worrying about Jews in Dakar and sending them matzah and making sure there's a minyan for Rosh Hashanah, and like the Rebbe's, like he doesn't have anything else to do, like a couple of families in Dakar. And then what happened was a number of months later, Rabbi Weinberg was again going to South Africa. So he went into the Rebbe's room and he asked for a bracha. The Rebbe said, "How are you going this time?" He said, "I'm going through Brazil, because I'm going to Brazil first. I'm from Brazil, I'm going to South Africa." So the Rebbe smiled and he says, "No, from Brazil to South Africa, you could stop a couple of days in Dakar." And then the Rebbe smiled and he says, "It doesn't always have to be because of engine trouble. You can do it, you can choose to do it this time." Which, by the way, is a good lesson. It's a good lesson anyway. You know, sometimes we do things in response to a crisis. You don't have to. You can do good things when there's no crisis, right? You can. Eventually, just to end the story, it's getting late. Eventually, actually, they became very connected. This one guy that he's talked to and he spent a lot of time with ended up going to France. He ended up meeting someone. He married. He set up a family. He ended up connecting with a Chabad emissary in Morocco, Rabbi Label Ruskin. And the last Rabbi Weinberg heard about him was that he was a full-fledged Chabad Chassid and completely involved and engaged. And that was all because there's many, many stories like this. But I just want to bring back to that thing about the individual, right? That the individual is important. Why do I reflect on all this? Because I spent a lot of time on this. Anyway, we'll get through all. So, because I reflect on this power that the Rebbe was, to him, any individual was important, any Jewish soul was important, and therefore spending time inspiring a 13-year-old boy was also incredibly important. So when I gave my note to the Rebbe looked up at me. The first question he asked me was, which had nothing to do with my note, he said to me, "What are you learning? Like, what part of the Talmud are you learning?" He asked me in Yiddish. So I said what I was learning, and then he said to me, "Do you, when you learn, do you translate?" He asked me in Yiddish, and I understood Yiddish. Yeah, he said, do you learn in English or in Yiddish? In other words, how do you translate? So I said, in English. So I was going to school, that the language spoken there was English. And so the whole audience turned to English. He switched to English and he spoke to me in English. But that question made a tremendous impact on me because I thought about it a lot over the years. And I don't think it was a question just for them. One of the things the Rebbe was very focused on, which sometimes when people write about the Rebbe, they forget this part. They talk about the Rebbe's outreach and the mitzvah campaigns and the love for the fellow Jew and all this kind of stuff, right? There's also a whole other side to the Rebbe, and that was scholarship and the emphasis and the importance of learning, the importance of engaging in Jewish education, not only for children, but for adults as well. I made Bina because of that question. In other words, I saw it was as an internal question. The importance of a Jew always saying, I go to this shir, or I learn this book, or I am engaged in this form of Jewish learning. Because we know this, and I'm sure I've shared this with you before, we know that from Jewish history, we've gone through many stages of Jewish history. We've had the temple, and then we didn't have the temple. Then we had the second temple, and then was that destroyed. Then we were in Rome, and we were in this place and that place, and now we're all over the place. So, and we had good times and bad times. We had times that was good for the Jews, like in Spain for a short time, and then times it was terrible for us. Since the Jews stood at Mount Sinai only over 3,300 years ago, there's one constant, there's only one thing that has been absolutely constant, and that is the need to learn, the need to study. Torah centers, Shiurim, Chavrusas, Talmud, whatever it was, studying was always the key. In fact, this was after the second temple was destroyed. Sorry, before the second temple was destroyed. I'm sure I've told you the story before, where Vespasian became the emperor, and Vespasian was a general. And one of the great sages managed to get an audience with him. And the whole story the Talmud says, but he asked him, he says, what do you want from me? He says, I want you to save the yeshiva. I want you to save the place of learning, the Sanhedrin it was at the time, and let them move to Yavne. He was about to destroy Jerusalem. And this great sage, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he saw with his holy vision that you can't, it's a decree, it's going to happen. Jerusalem will be destroyed. The temple will be destroyed. But he said, at least could you save the Sanhedrin? And the guy laughed. He said, I'm about to destroy their temple, the whole center of Jewish life. Well, he wants a couple of people to sit and learn, no problem. Go to Yavne. And they did. And then, after the temple was destroyed, the Romans realized their mistake. It became a thriving center of Jewish learning in Yavne, outside of Jerusalem, right? And then that's when the Romans started, this was the days of Rabbi Akiva, the Romans started enacting decrees against learning, and you had to hide to learn, you weren't allowed to learn. But they continued learning underground or risking their lives. Why? Because the Jewish nation's secret to survival is Jewish knowledge, understanding why we're Jewish, understanding what it is about being Jewish, understanding the soul, understanding the mitzvot, right? Otherwise, why do I need the tzaddis, right? Everyone talks, we keep talking about Jewish continuity and making sure that Jews continue. But at some point, people ask, I understand, but why? Like, why? And there's a deep faith, it's an intrinsic DNA conviction to remain Jewish and continue the chain, but also, you need to understand it, right? And knowledge gives passion, it gives excitement, you internalize it, you relate to it, it becomes something that's part of you. And that was my reflection on the first question that I've asked me. Then he proceeded to test me, which is a little bit, he didn't tell me in advance he was going to test me, you know, but he did. Thank God I knew the answers. Phew, I passed. He was very, very, very gentle. But I found out later this he would do with a number of bar mitzvah boys. He was sometimes asked them questions of what they're learning. And he asked me questions on the particular passages that I was learning and answered them. Then he asked me one question that I actually hadn't got up to there yet. But I remembered it from when I learned Chumash in the commentary of Rashi. And I told him, I said, I don't think I've learned that there, but I think the answer is, and I got it right. So that was good. But then the Rebbe did something that always happened in every single conversation. And I want to just focus on this for a moment. You know, today you can watch many, many conversations with the Rebbe, like his Sunday dollars, or when people come to see him, whatever the case is, right? Or read about audiences that people had. I don't think there was ever a conversation that someone had with the Rebbe that he didn't walk away with some homework, something that you had to do, right? Because what people often forget, people often talk about how they stood in front of the Rebbe, they never felt judged, the Rebbe accepted every Jew wherever they were. That is true. Never judge someone. And he never pushed someone out of judgment, but he did push people all the time. He was actually a very demanding Rebbe. Very. I don't think any, doesn't matter what levels of observance, it doesn't make a difference. Whatever you came to the Rebbe, so like, I'll give you a couple of examples. I remember watching, I do this often, it's very inspiring. I watched someone go by the Rebbe on a Sunday, and it was a person, a rabbi in Israel, who his grandfather had written stuff on the Chumash but never published it. So he decided to edit it and publish it, and he was all happy with himself. And he comes to the Rebbe and he says, I've just published the first volume, Bereshit, Genesis, all the commentaries of my grandfather. It's very beautiful. And he gave a copy to the Rebbe. The Rebbe said, thank you very much. Gave him an extra broch, gave him an extra dollar. And then right away, turns to the person and says, and what's about the next volumes? And this guy was planning, you know, it was a big job. I'm going to take a break now for a few years. The Rebbe says, no, what do you mean? Bereshit, now there's Shemot, Exodus, and then there's Vayikra, and there's Bamidbar, Dvarim, right? And the Rebbe takes out $4. He says, this is for the second, this is for the third, this is for the fourth, this is for the fifth. Got no choice, right? Everything like it. Doesn't matter who you were. It's always like, you know, always pushing people to do more. What does it mean? Because he didn't never demanded from people to do things out of judgment. He demanded because he saw the real person. The reason why he was so embracing and welcoming is because when the Rebbe saw a Jew, he didn't see who he or she was. He saw the neshama. He just looked at the neshama. That was obvious. He looked at, you're a yid. But when he saw through, even it could be a person that's really very complicated or failing, made a person made many mistakes, whatever the case is. But he saw a soul. And when he saw the soul, he saw how, what kind of potential that soul has. The infinite godly power that's in that soul. And the automatic flow on for that would be, no, you can do so much more. You can grow. When the Rebbe spoke about birthdays, he would say that every birthday a person has to, he talk about growth all the time. And every birthday he would say how a person, one of the things you have to do on a birthday is to reflect and take something new on. Make a resolution, something. Become a better person, a more spiritual person, a kinder person, a godly person, whatever. But grow. It was all about growth. So once he'd asked me what I learned, and I'd pass the test, he says, okay, now do you learn Chassidut from time to time? He said to me. Right? Do you learn Chassidut? Chassidut is the mystical part of Torah, right? Which the Rebbe, which in Chabad is a very, very important part. It was something that came down the generations from the Arizal and then the Baal Shem Tov, and the Rebbe held that our generation is incredibly important to understand the mystical meanings of, and in you know, of the mitzvot, of Torah, of God. And he asked me if I learned that from time to time, which I wasn't at the time, actually. So that was my homework. So the Rebbe said, now's the time. By the time I got back to South Africa, there was a rabbi who had been designated by my father to learn a thing once a week, and the journey, and now I teach a lot of Chassidut, but that's started then, where the Rebbe said, you need to start, and that was the homework for the thing. And then, finally, what he did was, he gave me, as you always do, because he had the philosophy, as I said before, that when two people meet, something good has to come for someone else. So I'm not sure about this number, but he gave me $4, and he gave me a beautiful blessing, all the things I've written in my note, plus more, it was a beautiful, beautiful blessing. We're also focused on learning. You should grow and you should succeed in your learning and the mitzvot and give nachas to your parents and so on and so forth. And then he gave me $4 and said, when I come to South Africa, I should give the value in the currency of South Africa, give it to charity. And this was a thing that I was very, very, very focused on. In fact, I want to just highlight it a little bit because, I mean, nowadays it's hard because we're becoming a bit of a cashless society, but the Rebbe was like, had this big campaign that every person, whether it's in a house, in their office, should have a tzedakah box, a pushkawai. Yeah. It wasn't just about philanthropy, it was about the action of giving. Because I spoke before about the Rebbe's scholarship, but at the same time, he was also very, very focused about power of an action. The power of helping another person, the power of doing one mitzvah. The Rebbe would always say when he started the mitzvah campaigns, and like, there were those that criticized the Rebbe, you know, the matzilin, mezuzah, Shabbos candles, right? There was a 10-point mitzvah plan, and some people criticized the Rebbe saying, what's the point, you know, these young students that go out in the street and they ask a Jew if they want to, they give a woman a Shabbos candle, or they give someone a one-time to put on tefillin. And they would say, like, I mean, the person's going back to his regular life, he's not engaging, he's not like, you're not going to make him more engaged Jew. One-time mitzvah, you never see him again, he never sees you again. First of all, it's not true, because there's so many stories about how one mitzvah led to so much more. But even if it doesn't, the Rebbe said it so many times so clearly, it doesn't matter. Because a mitzvah that you do is a power of an action, is eternal. And the Rebbe would send once, I remember one Purim, there's a recording of it, I wasn't born yet, but the Rebbe said, when a Yid does one mitzvah, just one time, the amount of joy that it brings God and the power and the impact of that mitzvah for eternity is so much. You never can undo a person can never do anything good, but if he does one mitzvah, that's like such a big thing. And when it comes to tzedakah, that I was very, very into this always, about the idea of, he would tell people to have a tzedakah box in their homes, and sometimes even babies, the Rebbe would ask that people should take young babies and put money in their hand and like make them give tzedakah, because train a person to give, just the power of giving, power of an action. So therefore, every time a person had a yechidut, a private audience, that would always be the case. And he told me that I should give a tzedakah, and then he gave me another short bracha, I should always hear good news, and that was the end of the audience. And it was just a most amazing, impactful thing. I'll just end with one little small thing, that when we left New York, so there, at that time there was a little bit of a custom, there were people who came to New York, and then they would leave, they came to visit the Rebbe, they would leave, there was a spot just outside, there was two shuls in 770, a small one upstairs and a big one downstairs, and during the week, the Rebbe would daven the afternoon services, the minchas it's called, he would daven in that small shul, and just near there was like an elevator, we should go upstairs to 770 to go. And there was like a sign, if someone stood next to the elevator when the Rebbe came out of the mincha services, it was like a sign that person was leaving, he was going on a trip. And very often the Rebbe would just stop and say, have a good trip. And the normal line that the Rebbe would say, he would say, for a gesund heit, which means travel well, travel safely, and we should always hear good news. So the day we left, which was a few days after that audience, we also stood there after mincha to get the Rebbe's final bracha for a good trip. And the Rebbe came out and he turned to my grandfather, gave the standard blessing, and he said, for gesund heit, travel well, we should always hear good news. And then he turned to me and he said, for gesund heit, travel well, and you should excel in your learning. It was like a very unusual blessing. So the Rebbe's brachas, I'm still working on it to be fulfilled properly. Never too late, we can always keep learning and hopefully it'll be properly fulfilled one day. But we're trying. But it just highlighted me the Rebbe's emphasis about the importance of learning and studying, and that ended up being my mission about establishing Bina, which is so that was my it was very impactful. 5 minutes, but such an impact, and I've never forgotten it. It's absolutely clear with me all the years. I actually wrote it down right. I typed it up actually when I came home. I wrote it down right away, and then I'll tell you one more thing. Later on, I know that because when I remember that my Zayda, also my grandfather, after I came out, I saw him in the small shul. It was late at night, really late at night, and he was writing because he also didn't want to forget what the Rebbe told him, so he was transcribing his yichidus, and he took it. Just a couple of years ago, my cousin in Israel calls me up. She says, "I think I found like these four papers of these notes, and I'm not clear when it was." She started telling me one or two things, and I remember my grandfather had shared with me, and it was like 10 points. And I said, that's the yichidus that Zayda had when he took me to the Rebbe. So I asked her to send it to me. She did. And there were some private things there, but there were some really, really important things there. One of the things, I'll just mention this because the power of a mitzvah, one of the campaigns that Rebbe made, especially at that time, it just had started, was the power of lighting Shabbat candles. And in fact, it was an interesting little story that happened when my grandfather was there for that half an hour. My grandfather... My sister was the latest grandchild at the time. I'm 10 years older than her. She was 3. And my grandfather was a bit Hamish with the Rebbe. Normal Hasidim wouldn't do this, but he showed the Rebbe a picture of her. And he wanted to give the Rebbe a picture of my younger sister. So that he had two pictures so the Rebbe could choose one. So the Rebbe looked at the picture and said, Sie benchlicht, she's lighting candles every Friday. And then it was a big campaign. Just the Rebbe started a huge campaign about even young girls lighting candles. And I'm saying it because the Rebbe actually asked him to publicize it. So I think it's nice to tell the story. So my grandfather said to the Rebbe, he wants to ask the Rebbe, he doesn't understand the campaign. Because he remembers where he came from in Poland, that was always the custom. That even young girls from 2 or 3 used to light candles every Friday night. Not just the mother, the young daughters as well, even very young. And he told the Rebbe a story, and I remember the candlestick, because that when my mother turned 3, they didn't have a lot of money, and it was a town called Dokshitsi. My mother left them when she was 4, but that they took a door handle and gave it to a smith to design a little candlestick. And he's telling this to the Rebbe, and he's telling the whole story, and the Rebbe's listening. When he finished the story, the Rebbe smiled broadly, and he said, That's exactly the point. I never actually came to do anything new. I just was trying to restore an old custom. And he said, I know people that have complaints. And they went on. So he asked him to publicize it. But the power, they spoke so much about the power of lighting candle. So I'm leaving you with that because the power lighting candle is so important. The Shabbat candle is such an important thing. It's the idea of bringing light to a world that we need lots of light to now. But what's so important, and the Rebbe would emphasize it so many times, of course, it's an obvious thing, but it's very important. The candle must be lit on time. Because there's a certain time you can't light it, it's too early to light. And of course, once Shabbat comes in, you really shouldn't light the Shabbos candles, even if you forget. So it needs to be lit on time. So I'll leave you with that. We should only have lots of light and simcha and bracha. Yes. Yeah, you can light electricals. Yeah. But it's good.
I have a dollar. I was given a dollar a couple of years ago. I think it was given to me for a tour. And I was told to keep it. I've got two questions. First of all, what should one do in the merit of a dollar that's given to you second hand? And secondly, a couple of days ago, somebody asked me the source of the dollars.
So the source is a Gemara, actually. It's a Talmud that says if a tzaddik gives you a coin, it's a bracha. What you do with it, I think if you receive a dollar, you give another dollar to tzedakah. That's the idea. At least. Tzedakah, yeah, for sure.
And what is the source of it?
It's in the Talmud. I don't remember exactly the source page, but it's in the Talmud.